You've all had a refill of caffeine. Yeah? We're all ready for the final run. Congratulations for making it so far. This morning's presentation is in two parts, and it's called Fingerprints of Divinity. The purpose of the presentation is to really look into Agatha Christie's famous line, "Who done it? Who wrote this book?" I know we've harped on the subject a little bit till now, but it would be interesting if we could find corroborating evidence, information that's part of other cultures, that identifies that the information in the book is accurate, and that it was written at the time of the events, not after, in the sense of, you know, this was written by people who invented the stories, which is a possibility we have to examine. Was it written by people hundreds of years after the acclaimed Exodus, who made up the story? Or are there other cultures that themselves testify to the Exodus and to the Jewish conquest of the land of Israel? In which case, it would be much more compelling for us to identify the true author of this book. So, when we start looking for identifying information, what should we look for? If we want to identify the true author of a book, what type of information would give us a very clear conclusion? For example, a signature. Okay, we want his fingerprints, we want his signature. We're actually going to look for four different types of fingerprints. The first fingerprint we're going to look for, I'm just calling it fingerprints. The first fingerprint we're going to look for is information that only the author could possibly have known. No human being would have ever made this up, not from a point of view of rationale, but just from the point of view of not having that information. Only the author of this book or the creator of the universe could possibly know this information. And so whoever wrote it could not have done it of their own volition. It must have been from a much higher, immanent power. The second fingerprint we're looking for is control of nature. Is there any evidence, indication in this book, the five books of Moses, that the author of this book controls nature and history? We looked at some of the prophecies that point fingers in that direction, but that's part of this criteria that we're looking for. A third item we're looking for, a third pink fingerprint, is very simply, we want total objectivity. We want that whoever authored this book, we want to be able to say they were not subjective. They were not interested in painting over mistakes of the people that they write about, but rather it was totally objective, truthful, realistic. We also want to look for a fingerprint called outside verification. Are there other cultures, or is there any scientific information that validates the information contained in this book? Those are basically the four that we're looking for. Now, what is the basis of this presentation? We've mentioned a number of distinctions between Judaism and every other, inverted commas, religion. I call it inverted commas because the claim of Judaism is that there's only one religion. There's only one God. So any other religion, so to speak, is man-made. Period. There's no negotiation as far as Judaism is concerned on that. But a major distinction is that in our own book of Deuteronomy, it's in chapter 4, and it's part of our liturgy and our prayers every morning, every afternoon, every evening, we sing the Aleinu Lishabeach prayer. We quote a line from Deuteronomy 4, where we say, V'yadata hayom, today you shall know, V'hashevotai levavecha, and bring it into your heart. First know it up here, rationally, and then become emotional about it, but not the other way around. And what is it that we should know? Ki Hashem hu Elokim, that God is the all-powerful, b'shamayim mima'al, in the heavens above, ve'al ha'aretz mitachat, and on the earth beneath, ein od, there is no other power. Now if the Torah is instructing us that we can know God from his book, and we scan the book for the evidence, and we can't find compelling information that says the author is definitely divine, then this claim is false, and we can throw away the entire Bible. So God has put himself on the line, because he's saying, you can know me. And it's a very interesting language, v'yadata, you shall know me, because what's the word in Hebrew for, which is usually translated as faith? Emuna. Emuna is translated as faith or belief. Is that correct? Where is that translation originally from? And unfortunately, most good Jewish translations actually still use that translation. St. James's Bible, thank you. And there's a problem with that. Because in order to understand God's intent when he used Lashon HaKodesh, the language of the Creator, we would have to really look at the original Hebrew and understand it from the Shoresh, the Hebrew grammar, the construction of the letters, to understand the original intent. The word emuna comes from the three letters amen. What does amen mean? I agree, this is true. What's the difference between saying I know and I believe? It's an enormous difference. In Hebrew, what is an uman? What is an uman? Same shoresh, the same root. An uman is a craftsman. Compare a craftsman, same root, emuna, which is translated as faith, belief. Consider a craftsman and compare him to a doctor. Now, it's true a doctor earns much more money, but when you go to a doctor and he gives you a prescription, and you take this scribble, forgive me if there's any doctors in the audience, you take this scribble to the pharmacist, and guess what? This is a total act of faith. True or false? You don't know he's going to cure. You hope, you pray, you have faith. He's got credentials, he's done it before. You go to the pharmacist, and the young lady behind the counter reads his scribble, takes out various combination of, I don't know what, from the shelves, combines it and gives it to you. And is there anyone who walked away from the counter saying, I'm not taking this until I study microbiology and medicine, 7 years of medical school, and then when I know what's going on over here, then I'm going to take it. No, we take it on faith. In fact, probably the amount of faith and belief we invest in going to the doctor and driving a car is far more than is required when we consider the evidence that we're going to look at this morning. Compared to an uman, a craftsman, when you give him the specifics of the cabinet you want built in this cove, which is exactly 58 inches and 7/8 of an inch wide and 6 feet and 2/8 of an inch high, do you believe or do you know that he can do it to the exact specification? And if he can't, he's not a craftsman. So the word uman, amen, from the word emuna, correctly translates as I am convinced. That's the correct translation. It's not as poetical as I believe. But when we read the 13 ma'ani ma'amins, I believe, it's not I believe, I am convinced. Because the Torah requires that the Jew does not take God's word on faith. The Torah does not require that the Jew takes God's word on belief. And that's why, out of all of God's credentials, and he's got quite a few, when he introduced himself for the first time nationally to the Jewish people at Mount Sinai, what were the opening words? Anoichi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God, Asher Hatziticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, who took you out of Egypt. Asks our famous commentators, Ramban and others, God, you know, you have other credentials on your resume, why don't you introduce yourself as I am the Lord your God, who created the universe. That's also very impressive. Why do you call yourself the God who took you out of Egypt? And the answer given is because you and I were not there at the time of creation. And so God would be requiring of us to believe in him on a level of faith. But we were there at the Exodus, and we stood at Sinai when he introduced himself as the all-powerful that was responsible for the plagues and the wonders, the splitting of the sea, and of course the script for the prince in Egypt. He is the one, all-powerful one, that now introduces himself as the God in history. That he is the one controlling the destiny of mankind. He is behind the events in our lives. And because we witness those events, now we are able to say, who is God? Just parenthetically, in Hebrew, how do you say spirituality? Ruchaniyut. What is the shoresh? What is the three-letter root of the word ruchaniyut, which means spirituality? Ruach. What does ruach translate as? Spirit or wind. Can you see wind? Can you hear wind? And the answer is no. When you see the leaves waving and rustling to the wind, and you see the trees waving in the wind, you can't see wind and you can't hear wind. You see how wind acts upon and you see the results of it. So it's interesting that in Hebrew, ruchaniyut, which is translated as spirituality, is a description of seeing the results of spiritual causes in a physical world. And so what we're going to be looking at are the four fingerprints that God left in His book to enable us to identify who is the real author of the five books of Moses. Let's look at the first fingerprint. We said the first fingerprint we're going to look for is identifying information that only the author of this book could possibly have known. And that's the following. In Leviticus 11, Moses tells us, in the name of God, God spoke to Moses. Here we are, a little toy over here. God spoke to Moses. There's an even better one. Okay, God spoke to Moses and Aaron, telling them to speak to the Israelites and convey the following to them. Of all the animals in the world, these are the ones you may eat. So he's going to give us a list of the ones that are permitted. Among mammals, you may eat anyone that has true hooves and that are cloven. That means split hooves, as you'll see down here. Split hooves and chews its cud. Chews its cud means many mammals have more than one stomach. And in chewing their food, it goes down into one stomach, comes back up, goes back down, and in various stages of digestion, eventually is finally digested. But that's what chewing the cud is referring to. So, of the cud-chewing animals and the hooved animals, these are the only ones that you may not eat. Now watch this carefully. The Torah has already given us two signs for a kosher animal. What are the two signs? Split hooves and chew the cud. Why don't you just leave it there? Don't tell us any more information. No. The Torah now goes and does something very risky. And watch the risk. These are the animals you may not eat because they only have one of the two qualifications. What's dangerous in saying these are the only four, which we're going to see in a moment, these are the only four animals which only have one of the two qualifications.
Some animals discovered in the future, then...
Thank you. What is your name?
David.
David is right on the ball. How can you make a claim that these are the four which only have one of the two qualifications? There are plenty of continents which haven't been discovered yet. There are so many animals that you don't have in the desert, you don't know in Egypt, they're part of other cultures and continents that haven't yet been known to man. So, Moses, are you a zoologist? In fact, the words of the Talmud is, was he a hunter? How do you come off saying these are the four which only have one of the two signs? Look at the wording. Among mammals you may eat, one second, where we are, here. These are the only ones you may not eat. The camel shall be unclean to you, although it chews its cud, it does not have cloven hooves. The shafan, which is some sort of rock badger, shall be a hare, shall be unclean to you, although it chews its cud, since it does not have cloven hooves. The arnevit, which is identified as a rock badger, but there are other possibilities, shall be unclean to you, although it chews its cud, since it does not have a cloven hoof, you can't have it. It's a one of two qualifications. And finally, the pig, which is the only one out of the four, which has cloven hooves, but does not chew its cud. The pig shall be unclean to you, although it has a cloven hoof, since it does not chew its cud. Do not eat the flesh of any of these animals. The obvious problem here is that how could Moses know there are no other animals? Is it a matter of tremendous discovery nowadays, after there are so many thousands of different animals that have been discovered on the different continents, it's such a great discovery nowadays, if a new animal has been discovered, that New York Times gives Indochina tantalizing traces of an elusive pig, gives a description of an animal which has not been known to man till now. The point being that in zoology, there's no other animal that's been identified that only has one of these two qualifications. Strange. Why do you put that information in there if you're a human being? How could you possibly know that? The other example, which is very famous, similar to this one, is the fish. What are the two qualities of a kosher fish? Scales and fins. And what is the claim? That if you find a fish which has scales, you can be guaranteed it has fins. What's dangerous about making this claim? Look at the wording here. This is what you may eat of all that is in the water. You may eat any creature that lives in the water, whether in the seas or rivers, as long as it has fins and scales. But all creatures in seas and rivers that do not have fins and scales, whether they are small or large water animals, they must be avoided by you. Same thing basically in Deuteronomy. Among that which is in the water, you may eat anything that has fins and scales, but those which have no fins and scales you may not eat, since they are unclean to you. Now, it's only part of the oral transmission, the volume called Nida, it's a Mishnah, which is chapter 6, Mishnah number 9. Every creature that has scales will also have fins, but there are those which have fins but do not have scales, saying that you will never find a fish that only has fins without scales. If it has scales, it always has fins. What's obviously dangerous? I mean, you didn't check out the oceans. Till today, we don't know how many sea animals and fish there are in the oceans. Because it's only recently, I remember about a year and a half ago, if some of you recall, in Time magazine, the front cover had a discovery that due to new technology, unmanned submarines are able to go as deep as 2 miles under the ocean and discover thousands of species of fish which were assumed till now impossible to survive under the water pressure at those levels, and yet there are color pictures of fish completely unknown to us. We don't even have names for them yet. So how do you know what's in the ocean? Was Moses a scuba diver? I leave you to judge.
Versus, let's say, a lizard or a snake.
Good question. How do you define a fish versus a lizard or a snake? So I'm not an expert in zoology fishology, marinology. But I will tell you that if an animal is living under the water and sleeping there, then you know it's a fish. If it's sleeping on land or coming up for its oxygen constantly, like an alligator, a crocodile, so that's a question whether it's really a fish. That's one fingerprint we're looking for, identifying information that only the author could possibly have known, and it's far too great a risk for a human being to say that this is absolute information which is humanly transmitted. The second, and this is fascinating, is outside verification. We're going to look now at outside verification. What does that mean? I'm going to share with you what is probably the most recent science of all. And its name is archaeology. Archaeology is one of the most recent sciences. What has archaeology dug up that will help us understand events that are claimed to have happened in the Torah, in the Bible? Let me quote to you, there's so many quotes here, I'm going to just give you a few of them and a couple of slides. William Foxwell Albright. The quotes I'm giving to you, for the most part, are non-Jewish archaeologists who have no specific interest in corroborating facts that are claimed by the Torah. The Mosaic tradition is so consistent, so well attested by different Pentateuchal documents, and so congruent with our independent knowledge of the religious development of the Near East in the late second millennium BC, that only hypercritical pseudo-rationalism can reject its essential historicity. He's basically saying that there's too much archaeological evidence to any for any scholar to seriously say that these events did not take place. That was William Albright, Archaeology and the Religion of Israel, page 96. In a different work of his, From the Stone Age, that's the name of the title of the book, New York, 1963, page 241, it is not our intention here to dwell on the history of the patriarchal age in Palestine. So many corroborations of details have been discovered in recent years, and we're talking about 1920s to 60s over here, that most competent scholars have given up the old critical theory according to which the stories of the patriarchs are mostly retrojections, meaning it was written in the future and making up stories about the past, from the time of the dual monarchy, 9th and 8th centuries. And now also from William Albright, biblical period, he's probably the most famous of archaeologists. Hebrew national tradition excels in all others in its clear picture of tribal and family origins. You can dig up the grounds of any continent in the world, you will not find as much history 6 feet below the ground, 18 feet below the ground, as the small strip of land called Palestine, the land of Israel, will identify. In Egypt and Babylonia, in Assyria and Phoenicia, in Greece and Rome, we look in vain for anything comparable. There is nothing like it in the tradition of the Germanic peoples. Neither India nor China can produce anything similar. In contrast with these other peoples, the Israelites preserved an unusually clear picture of simple beginnings, of complex migrations, and of extreme vicissitudes which plunged them from their favored status under Joseph to bitter oppression, of course referring to the Exodus. Until recently, it was the fashion among biblical historians to treat the patriarchal sages of Genesis as though they were artificial creations of Israelite scribes of the Davidic monarchy, or tales told by imaginative storytellers around Israelite campfires during the centuries following their occupation of their country, Israel. Eminent names among scholars can be cited for regarding every item of Genesis chapters 11 to 50 as reflecting late invention or at least retrojection of events and conditions under the monarchy into the remote past, about which nothing was thought to have been really known to the writers of later days. And he concludes, archaeological discoveries since 1925 have changed all this. Aside from a few diehards amongst old scholars, there is scarcely a single serious biblical historian who has not been impressed by the rapid accumulation of data supporting the substantial historicity of patriarchal tradition. William Albright, In the Biblical Period, that's the name of his book. I'll quote to you, a last one here, from Dr. Yohanan Aharoni, who is an Israeli archaeologist. Recent, and this is written in 1959, in his book Canaanite Israel During the Period of Israeli Occupation, published by the Israeli Defense Forces. Recent archaeological discoveries have decisively changed the entire approach of biblical critics. They now appreciate the biblical text as a historical document of the highest caliber. Their basic theories have been drastically altered because parallel documents have been found that describe the very same events recorded in the biblical narrative from the perspective of the ancient Egyptians, Assyrians, and Canaanites. Events described in the Bible no longer exist in a historical vacuum. Today, we are familiar with the general political map of the ancient world, its populations and its geography. We are familiar with the customs and the laws that are described in the Bible, as well as the names and places which are mentioned, all from archaeological excavations. All of these are compatible solely with the period of biblical history under consideration. No author or editor could have put together or invented these stories hundreds of years after they occurred. No one's going to dig up the ground, put all these artifacts there, and then cover it up to be found thousands of years later. No serious Bible scholar remains who can argue with the fact that these historical events were transmitted with incredible accuracy from generation to generation. Interesting. Let me show you some examples. Israel and Egypt. There are many details in Exodus about the Jews making bricks, the pyramids, we don't call them pyramids, but the Jews making the bricks as slaves. There are many details of when Joseph, for example, in chapter 31, was made viceroy, second in charge of the entire of Egypt. And in the detailed coronation of his new position, a number of different specifics were described. One of which was, we're going to the ring was placed on his hand. Now usually when you put a ring on someone's hand, what do you actually do? You take a ring and you feed it onto their finger. But the Torah doesn't say finger, it says hand. That's very unusual for most of us, and even previous cultures, rings belonged on hands. Signet rings of kings also belonged on their fingers. And yet, I don't have the slide here of it, it's in the book over here, that different sketches that have been found in Egypt show that a king that is appointing another person is placing a large ring in the hand, the palm of the hand, of the receiver. There are so many details that the Torah gives which are corroborated by archaeological finds that it's become impossible for a biblical critic to say these stories are not accurate. Look, for example, over here. Many additional pieces of evidence for the substantial historicity of the account of the Exodus and the wandering in the regions of Sinai, Midian, and Kadesh, these are all places mentioned in the Bible of Jews traveling, can easily be given thanks to our greatly increased knowledge of topography and archaeology. We must content ourselves here with the assurance that there is no longer any room for the still dominant attitude of hypercriticism toward the early historical traditions of Israel. Again, W.F. Albright from the Stone Age, page 255. Over here, now we learn from the reliefs of the 19th and 20th dynasties. These are called reliefs over here, etched in stone. We now learn from the reliefs of the 19th and 20th dynasties that brick making was indeed the occupation of many slaves in Egypt. We discover that straw or stubble was regularly used in Egypt to make bricks. In fact, when Pharaoh was first approached by Moses to let the Jews go, he not only said, "I've never heard of your God, get out of here," he increased the workload on the Jews. And in chapter 5, he told his taskmasters, "Tell the Jews that they should no longer expect us, the Egyptians, to supply them with the straw to make the bricks. They have to go and collect the straw themselves." We discover that straw stubble was regularly used in Egypt to make bricks, as this reinforced them. In one contemporary papyrus, that's again an etched stone, an official report of his workmen, and this is the translation given, "They are making their quota of bricks daily," while another complains, "There are neither men to make bricks nor straw in the neighborhood." Thus the book of Exodus accurately reflects brickmaking usage in ancient Egypt. And here's the relief of the brickmaking. See the ovens and the carrying of the bricks, etc. Here you have scribes and taskmasters or drivers beating their slaves. And again, archaeologists don't have a mission to prove the Bible right. They're just interested in finding what's underneath the ground. What historical evidence can they come up with that describes the past? Probably the greatest discovery of all is the papyri, which now is in the Netherlands, in the museum in Leiden. And this papyri, which was found in Memphis, not Tennessee, and has been translated. This is the papyri up here. A page from the papyri containing the story of the plagues. Here has been found an incredible account of a catastrophe which is taking place in a country called Egypt. And the catastrophe that is described, you will look and decide for yourselves how close is it in the detail that it gives to the description that we have in Exodus chapters 9 onwards of the 10 plagues. And ask yourself, listen, catastrophes can happen. Plagues of locusts are not unusual. Pestilence does happen. Hail can happen. But read carefully, watch carefully the detail and ask yourself, is this within the realm of a mathematical probability that all these plagues are being described in sequence this way? It is not known under the circumstances that the papyri containing the words of the Apuya, forgive me if I can't translate this correctly, Browns of Gray, was found, according to its first possessor, it was found in Memphis, by which is probably meant the neighborhood of the pyramids of Saqqara, in 1828. The papyri was acquired by the Museum of Leiden in the Netherlands and is listed in the catalogue as Leiden 344. The papyri is not a collection of proverbs or riddles. No more is it literary prophecy or an admonition concerning profound social changes. So what is being written over here? It is the Egyptian version of a great catastrophe. The papyri is a script of lamentations, a description of ruin and horror. Let's look at it more closely. What we're about to look at is the translation of what you have here. On this side is the papyri. On here is the parallel that's described in Exodus. Where's the Exodus 7? Papyri, and this is taken from part 2, verses 5 to 6, lines 5 to 6. Plague is throughout the land, blood is everywhere. 2:10, the river is blood. Men shrink from tasting, human beings and thirst after water. That is our water, that is our happiness. What shall we do in respect thereof? All is ruin. What was the life force of the Egyptians? The Nile. In fact, it was worshipped as a god. This is our happiness, this is our life. They've taken it away. Translation from Exodus 7. Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded. He lifted up the rod and struck the water in the Nile in the sight of Pharaoh and his courtiers. And all the water in the Nile was turned into blood. And the fish in the Nile died. The Nile stank so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile, and there was blood throughout the land of Egypt. They could not drink the water of the Nile. What about the pestilence? That's called Makat Dever. Papyri, part 5, line 5. All animals, their hearts weep, cattle moan. Exodus 9. Then the hand of the Lord will Then the hand of the Lord will strike your livestock in the fields, the horses, the asses, the camels, the cattle, and the sheep, with a very severe pestilence. Terrible suffering of animals. Plague of hail and fire. What is it doing on this papyri? Behold, cattle are left to stray, and there is none to gather them together. Each man fetches for himself those that are branded with his name. Forsooth, gates, columns, and walls are consumed by fire. We're told that the hail, this is part of the oral transmission, the hail came down as partial ice and partial fire. Total impossibility. Unless you're watching Disney. Therefore, I'll order your livestock and everything that you have in the open. This is an amazing warning Moses gives to Pharaoh. Before the hail comes down, I want you to know, anyone who's out there, it's blood on their head. Don't stick around when the hail comes down. Get out of here. Therefore, order your livestock and everything you have in the open brought under shelter. Every man and beast that is found outside, not having been brought indoors, shall perish when the hail comes down upon them. Those among Pharaoh's courtiers who feared the Lord's word brought their slaves and livestock indoors to safety. But those who paid no regard to the word of the Lord left their slaves and livestock in the open. Verse 23. So Moses held out his rod toward the sky, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire streamed down to the ground as the Lord rained. Beg your pardon, it's not the oral law. Down hail upon the land of Egypt. The hail was very heavy, fire flashing in the midst of the hail, such as had not fallen on the land of Egypt since it had become a nation. The hail also struck down all the grasses of the field and shattered all the trees of the field. Now the flax and barley were ruined. All this is part of Exodus 9. The papyri says, behold, cattle and field left astray, and there is none to gather them together. We left them outside. Trees are destroyed. No fruit or herbs are found. Hunger. Lower Egypt weeps. The entire palace is without revenues. To it belongs, by right, wheat and barley, geese and fish. Interesting. The parallel is uncanny. Plague of locusts. Same thing. For the sake of moving on, take a look at the death of the firstborn. Does this make sense? According to us, how and when did the death of the firstborn take place? All the plagues took how many days? Lasted for 7 days, except for the death of the firstborn. How long did it take? One moment. It happened in a moment. called midnight. And the moment midnight was over, the plague was over. It started and finished in 1 second. All the firstborn of Egypt were killed. Now, you'd expect a firstborn means just one in each family, correct? According to our oral transmission, a firstborn means a child that is firstborn from this mother's union with this man. Which means that if a woman gave birth to several boys, and each of them had a different father, they would each be considered a firstborn. In the middle of the night, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon. Why are you saying that? Just say all the firstborn. That's a strange detail to give. Who sat in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the cattle. And Pharaoh rose in the night with all the courtiers and all the Egyptians, because there was a loud cry in Egypt, for there was no house where there were not someone dead. The Egyptian urged the people on to make them leave in haste, for they said, "We shall all be dead." Look at the papyri. In the papyri it is said, the residence is overturned in a minute. The whole thing took place in a minute. Forsooth, the children of princes are dashed against the walls. The prison is ruined. 2:13, he who places his brother in the ground is everywhere. It is groaning that is throughout the land, mingled with lamentations. Forsooth, great and small say, "I wish I might die." The parallel doesn't make sense. How could it possibly be so accurately parallel to our own account? I will share with you the following. Professor Yisrael Eldad: objective research has proven time and again that the majority of analytical assumptions and biases that deny the historical validity of the biblical narrative have no scientific basis. It's basically saying archaeology has proven that all these events are true. On the contrary, what seemed to be religious myth and legend in the eyes of scholars has now been proven to be the actual events as they occurred. For the purpose of scientific investigation, if we disregard its supernatural character and view it solely in terms of the data we now possess, the Bible has withstood the test of both criticism and archaeology. Each passing year adds to our store of knowledge and provides us with more and more documents, inscriptions, monuments, excavations, which confirm its historical accuracy. Science is now in a position to state categorically that the Bible is factual until proven otherwise. And Professor Nelson Gluck, in Rivers in the Desert, page 31, not Jewish: as a matter of fact, it may be stated categorically that there are no archaeological discoveries that have ever controverted a biblical reference. Interesting. The quotes go on and on. But let me share with you the following. And this is absolutely fascinating. To date, our Torah, everyone agrees in the entire secular world that it's at least 2,300 years. Why? Because that's the first time it was translated into Greek, in the Septuagint. And you can't translate a document that doesn't exist, so it had to exist first. So we know we're translating a document called the Torah. So it's 2,300 years old. Archaeology has found, in the Qumran Caves, one book out of the five. It's almost complete, and it's the book of Deuteronomy, interestingly. And it dates back 2,800 years. But we still don't have evidence yet of our claim that the Torah dates back 3,311 years. 5 months and 15 days. But archaeology came up with the following. Very interesting. What was the leader of the Jewish people right after Moses? Who was the leader? Joshua. And what was he commissioned to do when he entered the land of Canaan? Destroy all the seven nations that are there. Actually, we didn't just go in and destroy them. We sent messengers giving an option of either make peace with us, and you live under our rule, or you can run away, or, if you want, battle. Three options. That's fair. The description in the book of Joshua, chapter 11, verse 10 to 13, And Joshua at that time turned back and took Hazor, the name of a city, and smote its king with a sword. For Hazor before time was the chief of all those kingdoms. Note that point. Hazor was the chief of all the kingdoms of that territory. And they smote all the souls that were there in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was not anyone left that breathed. And he burnt Hazor. Note this point. Hazor's the greatest kingdom out of all the kingdoms there. And it was burnt with fire. And all the cities of those kings and all their kings did Joshua take, and smote them with the edge of the sword, and he utterly destroyed them, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. But as for the cities that stood still on their mounds, all the other places in the land of Canaan, Yisrael burned none of them, except Hazor only. That did Joshua burn. So here we have a statement in the book of Joshua that there's a place called Hazor, that it was burnt, and it's the largest of its city of all the kingdoms in that entire territory. Let me share with you from John Bright, A History of Israel, page 130. Many scholars have seen... Sorry, I've got the wrong one. Here we are. Yigal Yadin, in his book Hazor, page 82. Last but not least, we have evidence that this magnificent city, with its thousands of inhabitants, was completely demolished by a sudden fire in the second half of the 13th century BCE. It was never built again. The similarity between the actual site of Hazor, as revealed in the digs, and that which is recorded in the book of Joshua, is astounding. The emphatic description of Joshua's demolition of Hazor, and only Hazor by fire, leaves little doubt in my mind that we have discovered the Canaanite city which was destroyed by Joshua, known as Hazor. In this case, archaeological evidence has directly contributed to establishing the date of Joshua's conquest, and indirectly the date of the Exodus. Note that point in just a moment. Abraham Malamet, in Eretz Yisrael in ancient times, that's the name of his book, page 57, Hazor in the north is the utmost importance here. Biblical tradition is extremely detailed as to its destruction. This has now been confirmed to have happened exactly as described and at the time described. Hazor is the largest ancient city dug to date in Israel. And it's the only one that's been found that is totally burned down. Now listen to this, very interesting. Exodus 34, verse 11, Moses tells Joshua, when you enter the land of Israel, Canaan at that time, and expel the seven nations, we knew there were seven nations. But strangely, only six are listed here. Be very careful, says Moses to Joshua, with regard to what I am instructing you. This is Exodus 34, verse 11. Be very careful with regard to what I am instructing you today. I will drive out the Amorites, Canaanites, Hivites, Perizzites, Hittites, and Jebusites out before you. Now, we have a problem, because there were seven nations, and the one missing is the Girgashites. Why aren't they mentioned there? So, Rashi, who's our famous biblical commentator, quoting the Talmud, the oral law, tells us on that verse, chapter 34, verse 11, there are only six nations mentioned here. Why? Because the seventh, the Girgashites, arose and emigrated of their own accord. They were one nation out of the seven that decided to take the first option was, let's get up and get out. Don't stick around because we're going to get beaten. Or under their rule, and who knows how they're going to treat us. And they ran away. But this is our oral transmission. It just happens to be that of the seven, only six were written in the written transmission, the Torah itself. So what happened to the Girgashites? Interestingly, the Jerusalem Talmud, also part of the oral law, recorded almost 2,000 years ago, states what happened to the Girgashites. Rabbi Shmuel said, Joshua sent three ultimatums to each of the seven nations in the land of Israel before entering its borders, declaring, he who wishes to leave of his own accord, let him do so. He who wishes to make peace, let him do so. He who wishes to make war, be prepared. Finishes off the Jerusalem Talmud, oral law, the Girgashites decided to leave because they believed and feared the God of Israel, and they fled to Africa. That's a dangerous detail. Listen to the following. Let's quote. The Byzantine historian Procopius, secretary of Belisa, reports a Phoenician inscription which was engraved on two stone pillars in Numidia, that's a place in Africa, and reads, "We are that fled before the robber, Joshua, son of Nau." And that's the end of the inscription. This inscription confirms the tradition that part of the population of Palestine fled to Africa when Joshua invaded the country. Modern biblical scholars, however, do not like it. Okay. Last example of outside verification that dates the Torah to the same date that we give it, and that's the following. In Deuteronomy chapter 27, Moses instructs Joshua with the following. When you enter the land, I want you to build an altar. And the only place you and I have any idea what an altar is supposed to look like is in Exodus 25, in the description of the tabernacle, where the altar is described as 32 cubits wide in length and width. And we're told about ramps, but the smaller details are only given in the oral transmission. So Moses tells Joshua in Deuteronomy 27, I want you to build an altar on Mount Ebal, right next to each other. On Mount Ebal. And that will be the place of sacrifices till the building of Jerusalem, which will be the permanent and only place for sacrifices in the future. The actual wording in Deuteronomy 27 verses 4 to 7. When you cross the Jordan, you shall set up the stones that I am now describing to you on Mount Ebal, and you shall plaster them with lime. There you shall then build an altar to God your Lord. It shall be a stone altar, and you shall not lift up any iron to it. The altar that you shall build shall be made of whole stones, and it's on this altar that you shall sacrifice burnt offerings. You shall also sacrifice peace offerings and eat there rejoicing before God your Lord. End of statement. Now, this is Deuteronomy 27. The book of Joshua has archaeologically been defined as an accurate description of events that took place at the time of Joshua. But look at what it said now in Joshua chapter 8, verses 30 to 31. At that time, Joshua built an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, on Mount Ebal. This is what the book of Joshua is saying. As Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the Israelites, as is written in the book of the teachings of Moses. This is straight out of the book of Joshua. So what is the book of Joshua claiming? That they built an altar on Mount Ebal, just as was commanded to Joshua by Moses. And we have that command on our claim in chapter 27 of Deuteronomy. A few years ago, Mount Ebal was dug up. And guess what they found in totally intact? A stone altar. Unfortunately, I don't have this on the slide. It was actually a color photo that was taken of it in, I saw it in Reader's Digest as well, but I don't have it here. This is the stone altar over here. It's difficult to see. But let me quote to you what the non-Jewish and Jewish archaeologists say about this finding. Adam Zertal of the University of Haifa headed a team of tens of archaeologists from Israel and abroad. Zertal said that in the wake of this discovery, we now have confirmation of the biblical tradition. This altar is the only one of its kind found in Israel. No sign of pagan idol worship were found there. This gives strength that this was a Jewish altar from the period of the Exodus from Egypt and the conquering of the land, which took place around 1300 BCE. And listen to this. One of the findings which confirms this dating is an Egyptian scarab with geometrical ornamentation which was found near the altar on Mount Ebal. Jews came out of Egypt and they were adorned with many jewels and ornaments which the Egyptians begged them to take. An additional 60 round and square stone implements were found, which were used for meal offerings. It appears that the sacred site was used as a center for pilgrimages and connected with communal sacrifices. The indications this discovery gives fits in with biblical traditions. This leads us to the conclusion that we have found evidence of an event in the book of Joshua. And hardly concealing his excitement, Zeratul added, it seems we found archaeological evidence of Mount Ebal's altar. And guess how long it is, and guess how wide it is. 32 amot, 32 cubits. And that's not all. What else was found when they dug up around and underneath the altar? Over 900 bones were examined from under the altar, and they were all from the four types of animals, goats, sheep, cattle, and antelope, the only four animals which are kosher for sacrifices. From our examinations, we are able to ascertain the sex and the age of the animals. They were all young males of about 1 year old. This corresponds remarkably with the laws of sacrifices in the books of Leviticus and Numbers. And he quotes, when one of you brings a mammal as an offering to God, the sacrifice must be taken from the cattle, sheep, or goats. If the sacrifice is a burnt offering, remember we said burnt offering before, that when Moses told Joshua, this site of Mount Ebal will be for burnt offerings, that means they're totally burnt on the altar. If the sacrifice is a burnt offering taken from the cattle, it must be an unblemished male and one yearling sheep without blemish. Interesting. The corresponding signs are beyond mathematical probability. How is one supposed to understand this? Fingerprint number 4. Objectivity. Whoever wrote this book, when you're going to, you know, if you write a diary about your family, are you going to add in and include every single crime and every single abuse, every single negative exchange between spouses and children in this diary? Why not? In fact, many cultures, historically, when they record their history, do they popularly add in when they were conquered? No. So in an ordinary document, thank you very much, an ordinary historical document, it's not unusual that we cover up the mistakes of leaders. In fact, what happened to Rushdie? You remember Rushdie a number of years ago when he wrote a few lines against Muhammad and the Quran? Poor guy, Islamic himself, right? He's been chased by pretty much every Arab in the world. He had to divorce his wife, went into hiding with her children. And yet, when we look at our Bible, look at our Torah, how are our leaders and our own people described? Subjectively or objectively? Moses, in chapter 20 of Numbers, strikes the rock instead of speaking to it, and God says, right, because you didn't believe in me, you will not enter the promised land. Moses, the leader of the Jewish people, don't you think he had a right to enter the land? That he was the lawgiver, he helped redeem, he was the one that initiated all the plagues at the hand of God. I mean, because he struck the rock instead of speaking to it, now he can't enter the land? And then God reminds him of his sin right at the end of Deuteronomy 32, verse 57. He says, the reason why you're not entering the land is because you didn't believe in me. Didn't believe it. Our righteous individuals are held to the highest level of being judged on a hairbreadth for what they are expected to hold to in their level of righteousness and their standard of behavior. Miriam, in chapter 12, spoke a little bit derogatorily about her brother Moses, and she's speaking to who? Aaron. This is all within the family, and God gets angry with Miriam and puts on her a leprosy, a form of skin disease, that she was quarantined for 7 days, and it's described openly in Numbers chapter 12. The Jewish people had to wait 7 days till she was cleared of this disease, and then they continued their journey. These are our leaders, and you're putting their mistakes right in our document. Who writes this way about their family? How about the Jewish people themselves? Are we spoken about in very endearing and loving terms all the time? Yes, you promised we're an eternal nation and you will never forsake us. But then, we are berated and reprimanded constantly throughout the entire Torah and Scripture and all the prophets, no end. Korach's rebellion, an entire rebellion against Moses is recorded in chapter 16 in Numbers. And then the spies in chapter 34. Every mistake that we did, either the leaders or the people, right, you're going in the book. We're putting that in the diary. And what's more, we're going to make sure everyone can read this. What's the matter? This is shameful. Don't keep it in the family. Put it as part of the oral transmission. Why do you put it? Someone might translate this into 70 languages one day. We complain for water in Exodus 16. We complain for meat in Numbers 11. And we say, we're getting tired of this journey. Also in Numbers chapter 11. Constant complaints, complaints, complaints. And what are we called by God and Moses? Stiff-necked, stubborn people. Is that complimentary? How are you then going to put that into writing for everyone to see? Is this subjective or clearly objective? See, this is not a book of history. This is a book of truth. This is not a book of just a nation and what happened. We are putting down the mistakes because these mistakes are for us to learn from forever. We are ashamed and we apologize, but God's not going to cover it up. Because this is a book of truth. Now let me ask you. You and I are standing on the shore of the Jordan River, about to enter the promised land. We've had this book now given to us, and we each have our own scroll. And we're reading it through, and all these accounts of specific people, and sometimes tribes, entire tribes that behaved in a wrong way, are described here in detail. Do you feel proud to take this along, or are you going to argue? Why are you putting this in here? Unless this is clearly a divine document, why would we unquestioningly continue this document and swear to transmit it accurately to our children and children's children forever? Unless the fingerprints are not Moses. Without knowing who the true author is, there's only two possible conclusions we can come to looking at this document, looking at this scroll. Whoever wrote it hates us, or he's writing a document of truth, naked reality. This is how it was. This is exactly how it was. You complained, you complained, you complained. I want more water, I want meat, I'm tired. There's no end of it. I'll give you a quick joke. There was a Jew who once went to a Tibetan monastery to find out truth and want to meditate for years and years. He comes to the dean, and the dean says, you know what? In this monastery, the rule is you meditate for 10 years, we'll offer you 2 meals a day and boarding, but you've got to meditate for 10 years at a time, and at the end of each 10-year period, each decade, you come before us and you say 2 words of wisdom that you have thought through in your 10 years of meditation. So he goes out into the mountains, valleys, meditates for 10 years, comes back after 10 years, year after year after year, 10 years, comes back, and the dean says, no, let's hear what 2 words of wisdom, of philosophy, of the depths of mysteries of creation that you have delved into. And he comes out with, food cold, and walks out. Continues meditating for another year, 2, 3, 10 years go by, comes back to the dean, and he says, congratulations, you've managed 20 years of non-stop meditation, amazing. What 2 words of wisdom are you going to share with us? Bed hard. Storms out. Another year, 2, 3. 10 years later, 30 years of meditation comes back. And the dean congratulates him. 30 years of meditation. What are you going to share with us? What 2 words and depths of mystery? He says, I quit. Storms out the room. And the dean turns to the secretary. He says, I'm not surprised. From the day he arrived, he never stopped complaining. The Jews complained and complained and complained. And it's written. This is a book that's clearly objective. Another fingerprint. Objectivity. And last of all, control. Control over nature. Very strange. One of the mitzvahs that Moses gives us is Aliyah L'Regel. What does that mean? Three times a year, we are commanded, all the Jews, wherever we're living, what do? Pick up and move to Jerusalem. And we have a national gathering, Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot. And we celebrate for a number of days there. And what does God say? Don't worry about your borders, because I'm taking care of you. Right? Now, if you're listening to Moses give this command, as he writes it down, what are you going to say? Oh, this is great, Moses. We're so many surprises, we can't wait to hear what you're going to say next. What are you and I going to say? What are we going to eat? Okay. What's the biggest danger of Jewish people coming to Jerusalem three times a year? Three times a year, all your males shall appear before your God, Master, Lord of Israel, when I expel the other nations before you and extend your boundaries. No one will be envious of your land when you go to be seen in God's presence three times a year. That's the translation of the Hebrew, taken from Exodus 34. What God is saying to us through Moses, if it's God or Moses, whoever, is saying that no one's going to be envious, no one's going to attack you, it's not going to be a Yom Kippur 1973, don't worry, just go to Jerusalem. Don't worry about your borders. Your wives and children, if they stay home, they'll take care of the borders for you. This is a prescription for national suicide. Who's going to buy this document? Who's going to accept Moses? You know, I like the one about love your neighbor, and I like the one about don't kill and don't steal, but this is ridiculous. How are you going to guarantee me safety? It's national security at stake over here. Who's going to buy into a mitzvah, an instruction of this nature, unless they are convinced who is in control of other nations attacking or not attacking us? And the second example is taken from another mitzvah, which is very strange, and that's the sabbatical year. Moses tells us, Leviticus 25, for 6 years you may plant your fields, prune your vineyards, and harvest your crops. But the seventh year is a Sabbath of Sabbaths for the land. It is God's Sabbath during which you may not plant your fields nor prune your vineyards. Do not harvest crops that grow on their own, and do not gather the grapes on your unpruned vines, since it is a year of rest for the land. Keep my decrees, safeguard my laws. If you keep them, you will live in the land securely. The land will produce its fruit and you will eat your fill, thus living securely in the land. If you ask, you know, if we're supposed to keep every seventh year fallow and we don't touch the land, if you haven't harvested and sown in the seventh year, what's the obvious question? How am I going to eat in the eighth year? Actually, how am I going to eat in the eighth and ninth? Because in the eighth I've got to sow and plant to be able to eat in the night. So really you're asking me not to be worried about what I'm going to eat in the 7th and 8th year. I mean, this is getting ridiculous. So how are we supposed to live? Well, so Moses says, that's not a problem. If you are so intelligent to ask, if you ask, what will we eat in the 7th year? We have not planted, nor have we harvested crops. Don't worry. I will direct my blessing to you in the 6th year, and the land will produce enough crops for 3 years. Is that an intelligent answer? God says, don't touch the land. Now, it happens to be in agriculture. What do people know? What do? They give the land a rest. Yeah? Anyone who flies over the continent of America, you look down and you see lots of patches. Have you noticed the round patches? And they look like pies. What do you notice? Different colors. Why? Because one section has been given a rest while the other is being nurtured. Correct? But what are they doing? Rotating. But do you see entire expanses where for 1 year nothing is everything is left fallow? No, they're rotating, but they still have other patches of land which they are cultivating. But that's not what's being asked of us over here. The entire land has to be left fallow in the seventh year. So how are you going to live? Oh, no problem, I control nature, says Moses. Who's going to buy that? This is national suicide all over again. Totally irrational. That was fingerprint number 4. Control of nature. I suggest we take a break. And in the second part, I will finish off the control of history and come to the conclusion of the fingerprints of divinity. Thank you for your patience.